KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders are assessing what the next Trump administration means for their communities. Tamara Grove is a Republican state senator from Lower Brule, South Dakota. She says there's reason to be hopeful in the next administration, namely the representation of states with high tribal populations with the incoming government.
I'm hopeful that this 4 years will include the Native American community. When you have people like John Thune in office who says South Dakota, right? Like, we've got 9 tribes here. So I just really believe that will open up some doors.
On the other hand, Pine Ridge Democrat Representative Puri Poyer says she's cautiously optimistic, including with some cabinet picks, like former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum for Secretary of the Interior.
It seems like that he has a good grasp on trust responsibilities with Native American tribes and the treaty obligations. I hope he holds the BIA accountable in all aspects. I hope he initiates policy reform and really weighs out their performance when it comes to public safety efforts.
Burgum previously prioritized tribal relations during his time as governor. In Alaska, Bethel's tribal government recently repatriated the remains of 4 Yupik ancestors taken from the area more than a century ago. KYUK's Evan Erickson has more.
At the Bethel Memorial Cemetery at the edge of the tundra, a large wooden cross protruding from a single gravesite bears only the words, 4 Yupik ancestors. In November, the partial remains of 4 Yupik inhabitants of the Bethel area were finally laid to rest by Bethel's tribe, the Arutzaharamute Traditional Native Council, known as ONC. They'd been stored at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology for more than a century. The repatriation is the product of a years-long process under the Federal Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA. The law has facilitated the transfer of the remains of tens of thousands of Native Americans stored in museum collections and laboratories back to federally recognized tribes since its passage in 1990. Nevertheless, hundreds of thousands of remains and sacred objects still remain in the possession of museums, universities, and federal agencies across the United States. At the request of ONC in November, the city of Bethel agreed to dig a gravesite for the remains at the Bethel Memorial Cemetery. In a meeting of the Bethel City Council shortly after the burial, Acting City Clerk Kevin Morgan shared an email sent to the city by the tribe describing the remains.
It was an adult male, the cranium, the mandible of a female, mandible and part of the skull of a female, and the cranium and cranial bones of about a 15-year-old female.
Notice of the ancestral remains as required under NAGPRA was first made by the National Park Service in late 2022, though it is unclear when Bethel's tribe received the remains. ONC did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Little is known about the 4 recently buried Yupik ancestors, but according to the Federal Register, the remains were removed from a site near Bethel in September 1907 as part of a Western Alaska expedition led by Penn Museum's General Curator of American Archaeology, George Byron Gordon. That same year, Gordon collected and removed hundreds of cultural items from the region as part of a canoe expedition of the Kuskokwim River that brought the anthropologist to Bethel. Penn Museum did not respond to multiple requests for comment about the history of the remains while in the museum's possession. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
educators. Ready to transform Indigenous education? The NISN School Design Fellowship is accepting community letters of interest through January 31st at NACAinspiredschoolsnetwork.org, who support this show.
Fry Bread, that's the message. Support by Val's Fry Bread, providing her famous fry bread mixes and other products in wholesale and retail quantities at valsfrybread.com. Fry bread that will take you home, available wherever you live.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
I wonder what we've come to here. This aspect of the pardons right now I find very, very troubling.
Senator Lisa Murkowski opposes President Trump's pardons of convicted January 6th rioters. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 22nd. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, Governor Dunleavy praises Trump's executive orders aimed at resource development in the state.
This is like unwrapping a gigantic sled of Christmas presents for the state of Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
How does Alaska's land fund community services for Alaskans with behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities? Through the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Trust Land Office manages 1 million acres of lands to maximize revenue generation, with earnings supporting millions of dollars in trust grant making each year to help improve mental health outcomes for beneficiaries statewide. More at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Senator Lisa Murkowski today condemned President Trump's pardon of those who attacked the Capitol on January 6th 4 years ago. She's one of only a few Republicans in Congress who have said so clearly. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports on the fallout from those pardons at the Capitol today.
Murkowski says Trump's decision to pardon 1,600 people, even those who assaulted police officers, is a terrible precedent.
Pardons of those who have been found guilty of crimes. Very serious crimes. I wonder what we've come to here. This aspect of the pardons right now I find very, very troubling.
She also issued a social media statement saying she strongly denounces the blanket pardons of people who assaulted Capitol Police. Senator Dan Sullivan declined multiple interview requests this week to talk about the pardons.
We'll send you whatever question you have, I'll send you a statement.
Sullivan's statement says he doesn't know the details of all 1,600 cases, so he can't comment on the specifics. But Sullivan says President Biden's decision to commute the sentences of murderers was worse. Biden, in his final days, set free several felons who had served decades in prison. Sullivan's statement ends by saying that, quote, if someone committed acts of violence against law enforcement officers, they should be held accountable, unquote. Alaska Congressman Nick Begich says many of the January 6 defendants were nonviolent. When asked about Trump's decision to pardon people who had assaulted police officers, Begich also raised Biden's use of the pardon power.
For those folks President Trump chose to pardon, you know, they've served their time. They've met their obligations within his capacity to make those pardons. I mean, I think we saw some very controversial and concerning, frankly, last-minute pardons for Joe Biden's personal family members.
Begich says the Constitution gives the president the power to pardon people at his discretion.
I think that many people will agree, me among them, that those 1,500 folks, by and large, deserve to be pardoned.
Meanwhile, some of the January 6 attackers were back at the Capitol this week. Reporters snapped photos of Stuart Rhodes eating lunch in the basement cafeteria of the Longworth House office building. Rhodes had been serving 18 years for a seditious conspiracy until Trump commuted his sentence on Monday. And some of the officers who were attacked 4 years ago told reporters they're horrified to see their assailants back in the buildings they serve in.
I was beaten, crushed, kicked, punched, surrounded, Someone reached underneath my visor, tried to gouge out my eye.
Daniel Hodges is the officer on a widely seen video being crushed in a doorway by the January 6th mob.
The people who attacked us on January 6th are free now. They can try it again. And they'll know if they try it again in the next 4 years, they know they'll get pardoned again.
Hodges was off duty as he spoke, but just finished four 12-hour workdays to ensure Trump's inauguration was peaceful. Murkowski has more than once angered Trump and his supporters. Still, she says, this is the United States of America, and even with the pardons, she feels she's safe from political violence. Reporting from the Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Governor Mike Dunleavy this afternoon praised a series of executive orders President Donald Trump issued shortly after taking office. Trump issued an order aimed at expanding resource development in Alaska alongside dozens of other executive actions on his first day back in power. The order calls for more drilling, mining, and logging in the state, things like new oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, reapproval of the Ambler Mining Road, and removing protections from roadless areas of the Tongass National Forest. Dunleavy says it's good news.
I mean, from my perspective, this is happy days are here again, to be perfectly honest with you. This is like unwrapping a gigantic sled of Christmas presents for the state of Alaska.
Ahead of Trump's inauguration, Dunleavy submitted something of a wish list to the incoming administration, requesting an order rolling back Biden-era decisions that limited resource development. Trump granted many, though not all, of those wishes. State lawmakers offered mixed reactions to Trump's order. Senate Majority Leader Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican, says she shares Dunleavy's view that the state should take a bigger role in managing Alaska's land and waters. But she said casting aside environmental protections could be unwise.
We're not a colony to be pillaged. And by throwing open all of the regulations related to resource development, we could be jeopardizing our lands and waters.
Minority Republicans in the House and Senate both praised Trump's resource development order, but state lawmakers more broadly opposed another Trump order renaming the mountain known as Denali to Mount McKinley. Representative Maxine Dybert, a Fairbanks Democrat, referenced her own Koyukon Athabascan heritage and said Denali is one of many place names that reflect Alaska's diverse languages and cultures.
Mr. Speaker, changing the name of Mount Denali to Mount McKinley would be costly and, if enacted, would be disrespectful to Alaskans. Denali is a great American name and is a great American mountain.
Dybert was one of two Interior Democrats to introduce resolutions today urging the federal government to retain the name Denali. Dunleavy, though, declined to share his thoughts on what the mountain should be called. He says he wants to speak with Trump one-on-one before offering up his own view.
Until I have the conversation, I'm going to refrain from saying what it should be or shouldn't be, but right now the name is Denali. We'll have that conversation with the president, and I'll be able to get back to you guys and let you know how that went.
Dunleavy recently returned from attending Trump's inauguration. He says he hopes to speak to Trump about the name change next month. Meanwhile, the number of jobs in Anchorage is expected to fully recover from the COVID-19 pandemic this year. But business leaders say the lack of housing and overall high prices continue to make it difficult to attract and retain workers. Those are a few of the headlines from the annual Anchorage Economic Development Corporation forecast released at a luncheon downtown today. President and CEO Jenna Wright says Anchorage saw slight population growth in 2024 for the first time since 2016. She says 2024 was a, quote, really good year overall for the city's economy.
For the first time in almost a decade, we are so thrilled to report that Anchorage's population expanded ever so slightly. The city added thousands of jobs, our incomes increased, and our population even edged higher for the first time in many, many years.
The city's population is forecast to stay steady, according to the report, but the working age population shrank for the 11th consecutive year. As Anchorage's population continues to age, Wright says the city is competing at a national level to increase the labor pool.
What we're seeing is that many Anchorage-based companies are staffing up as best they can in-state, but they're also working with Lower 48 union halls to try to get the workers they need for the busy construction season.
Anchorage hasn't built enough housing to meet demand, and Wright says it's a barrier for employers to hire workers. The price of the average single-family home last year was $514,000, according to the report, 40% higher than in 2019. Mayor Suzanne LaFrance says the city is working to build 10,000 homes in 10 years in an effort to curb out-migration and homelessness.
Our strategy, 10,000 homes in 10 years, is a direct call to action.
knowing we need about 1,000 units of housing a year to ensure that Anchorage is a viable place to live for all who call it home.
Construction and healthcare are expected to lead job growth, according to the forecast. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, researchers unearth a Dene food cache in Anchorage nearly 1,000 years old.
It was very, very exciting because it makes it the oldest documented site in the Anchorage Bowl area for that type of organic layer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Within hours of returning to the country's highest office Monday, President Donald Trump formalized his support for the $44 billion Alaska LNG project. Support for natural resource development in Alaska as the official policy of the United States was tucked into the flurry of executive orders Trump signed on his first day. According to Trump, that means prioritizing development of LNG for sale and transport to other parts of the country and its Pacific allies, including via the Alaska LNG project. If it's built, the Alaska LNG project would move natural gas from the North Slope to South Central through an 800-mile pipeline. The gas would be liquefied at a facility in Nikiski and then shipped overseas. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation is the state agency overseeing the project. In a statement Monday, Corporation President Frank Richards said he looks forward to working with the president on the project, but some state lawmakers expressed skepticism about Trump's energy agenda and the project's future as the legislative session kicked off Tuesday in Juneau. Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel criticized a $50 million backstop the state's development agency okayed for a company to update the project's 10-year-old engineering and design work. The money was included in the governor's proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year.
We're offering now a completely risk-free $50 million to a company. We don't know what the product is going to be, and if it's a nothing product, we still are paying $50 million. I question whether it was Ada's authority to take part of the take the $50 million they actually owed us as a dividend and appropriate it for this.
Bethel Democratic Senator Lyman Hoffman co-chairs the Senate Finance Committee. He says energy is a priority this session, but called Ada's backstop a, quote, bad precedent.
The question has to be asked, will the federal government come up and pony up to assist and to what level in the construction of this gas line? The president wants to develop Alaska resources, and to what level and to what extent will that be for a gas line?
Geisel says lawmakers were scheduled to take up a variety of energy issues during the first meeting of the Senate Resources Committee today. According to the committee's agenda, lawmakers heard from representatives of Hillcorp Alaska and Hex Fury. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is poised to be the country's new Health and Human Services Secretary with the incoming Trump administration. If confirmed, Kennedy has pledged to advise all U.S. water systems to remove fluoride from public water. A growing number of cities in the U.S. have already done that on their own, and residents' teeth offer a preview of how that policy could affect dental health nationwide. Juneau pulled fluoride from its tap water nearly two decades ago, and as KTOO's Clarice Larson reports, data shows kids in Juneau are getting more cavities.
So dry, and paint.
Dr. Yvonne Tijerina Burleson uses a tiny toothbrush to paint topical fluoride on a patient's teeth.
Simple, with some amazing benefits.
They're at Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium's dental clinic in Juneau. The patient chose marshmallow flavor.
Yeah, it smells really good. These would be great candles. Candle scents.
Applying topical fluoride is a typical practice for most dentists across the U.S., but in Juneau, it's an especially critical one. That's because it hasn't been in the water for nearly two decades. And since then, data shows kids in Juneau have started getting cavities at a higher rate. Dr. Dane Lineker directs dental services for the Search Clinic.
Fluoride
has a, as we would say, a karyoprotective effect. Like it can prevent cavities. It can slow down the disease process. Fluoride can help remineralize and strengthen the teeth.
Around 70% of the U.S. population has access to fluoridated tap water. Dental experts and studies say it helps prevent cavities.
Fluoride, if you're not getting it in the water system and it's not getting incorporated into your teeth that way, this is another way that it basically gets painted onto your teeth.
Public health officials say putting a small amount of fluoride in the water supply is an easy and cost-effective way for large-scale cavity prevention. But some researchers and critics, like RFK Jr., argue it may lead to health issues. RFK Jr. says fluoride is industrial waste and associates it with issues like lower IQ in children. Now, there's some evidence of that at high levels of exposure, but not at the level that goes into U.S. water supplies. There's conflicting narratives, but one thing is clear. The U.S. is seeing more and more cities opt out of fluoridated tap water. About two decades ago, Juneau residents overwhelmingly voted to remove fluoride from the local water supply. And if Juneau's dental health now is any indicator of what's in store for cities that might follow RFK Jr.'s advice, America could be seeing a lot more cavities.
I think Juneau offered us a good example of some of the challenges we set ourselves up for when we decide to stop fluoridating the water.
Jennifer Meyer is a public health researcher who conducted a study that shows that kids in Juneau have needed more dental work since they stopped getting fluoride in the water.
Places that are going to cease fluoridation, just hold on to your pocketbook because it's going to get expensive.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would agree with that claim. Her study focused specifically on the teeth of children under 6 in Juneau. She used a set of Medicaid dental claims to get data for nearly 2,000 kids, a decent sample size for a small town.
What we know happens is over time, you start to see kids with more and more decay and some with some really advanced decay.
Her study found that when the water had fluoride in it, kids had an average of 1.5 cavity-related procedures per year. But once it was gone, that went up to about 2.5 procedures a year. Her Juneau-specific study's conclusion is not far off from what other researchers say. The CDC calls the fluoridation of drinking water one of the greatest public health interventions of the 20th century, attributing it to averting millions of cavities in the decades it's been implemented. The American Dental Association shared a statement this fall that endorsed water fluoridation, saying there's clear and compelling evidence around the benefits of it. Still, not everyone is convinced. David Hamm is one of the advocates who wanted to remove fluoride from Juneau's water. He doesn't have a problem with fluoride on his teeth. He has a problem with drinking it.
I used a fluoride toothpaste, and then I could spit out the toothpaste and not swallow it and ingest a questionable substance into my body.
He sees the value in fluoride, but argues that it can be administered in ways other than putting it in the water supply. But not everyone has access to regular dental care or fluoride pills. Health officials say fluoridated water is especially important for kids in vulnerable populations.
We all want to have a silver bullet solution to a problem, but there isn't, because life isn't like that. Fluoride, this fluoride issue is not like that. There are steps you can take that don't involve telling everybody to, you know, drink fluoride.
Now, no one in Juneau drinks fluoride. It's an all-or-nothing situation, and the city's experience shows that when people have to opt in to use fluoride, it can lead to more cavities. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. You can make a difference in the lives of Alaskans. Every year, hundreds of nonprofits provide warm meals, safe places, and resources to hundreds of thousands of Alaskans. By supporting Alaska's nonprofits when you apply for your PFD, you're giving more opportunity, more hope, more chances. This year, make more possible with the click of a button. Don't forget to give via PickClick Give when you apply for your PFD. This message sponsored by PickClick Give.
A nearly 1,000-year-old cache linked to the Dene people was found near Cook Inlet this summer. Researchers say it's the oldest such find in the Anchorage Bowl. For the Alaska Desk, Aliona Naidzin has more.
Archaeologists discovered a cellar lined with birch bark in June at a known Dene site at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. They estimate that the cache was about 3.5 feet across and was likely used for storing food. Aaron Leggett is the president of the native village of Aklutna, located roughly 20 miles north of the discovery. He says it's another testament that the Dene people have been the stewards of the lands in south-central Alaska for at least a millennia.
Further confirmation of Dene oral tradition. It also shows that there's still a lot more work to be done on Dene archaeology, and especially in Upper Cook Inlet.
J-Bear archaeologist Liz Ortiz was among those who first encountered the cache. Ortiz says that she and her colleague expected it to be a couple hundred years old. Instead, tests showed something extraordinary for South Central, a relatively densely populated region where ground conditions are less stable compared to other parts of the state.
When we got the results back that said it was 960 years plus or minus 30, we were shocked. I mean, Morgan and I were jumping up and down in our cube and tears. It was very, very exciting because it makes it the oldest documented site in the Anchorage Bowl area for that type of organic layers.
The birch bark that lined the cache was likely there to keep dirt, moisture, and rodents out. Since the site is so close to the water, Ortiz says they expected to see traces of marine animals and fish inside the cellar, but the soil samples showed terrestrial animals instead. Researchers still need to test the soil outside the pit to see if those samples show what was stored inside the cache or which animals lived in the area. The discovery happened at a scenic spot perfect to watch for belugas, says J-Bear archaeologist and Ortiz's colleague, Morgan Grover.
All of a sudden, you're at the top of the hill, and there's giant spruce trees and birch trees, and Knik Arm is just right there in front of you.
Researchers collaborated with elders and knowledge holders from Dena'ina and Atna tribes to get more context about the place. They learned about one physical landmark at the site, an old birch tree that has a letter T carved into it. Aklutna elders remember a fish camp in the area that belonged to the Theodore family with ties to Aklutna and Knik tribes. Some of them believe that the carving was a landmark for the camp. Grover says that such discoveries are important to discuss. They highlight the long-standing indigenous history of the urban landscape of Anchorage.
Anchorage is a new town. You know, 1914 is when it's first established, but there are people who were here much longer than that. And they were amazing stewards of this land, and so we have to make sure we acknowledge that.
Leggett, with the native village of Aklutna, says that the Dene'ina people often followed the coast to get to fish camps in the Anchorage area. Today, half of Alaska's population lives within the Dene homelands, and Leggett says careful analysis of the remaining sites, in consultation with the tribes, is crucial.
We know we can't stop development, but can we use these opportunities to kind of fill in the picture?
Archaeologists plan to further evaluate the soil samples in and around the cache. Together with tribal leaders, they hope to go back to the site later this year. In Anchorage, I am Aliona Naidin.
Mountain Village School on the Lower Yukon River hosted their first ever self-made book fair earlier this month, and the first in years since Scholastic Books changed their shipping policies affecting schools off the road system. As KYUK's Samantha Watson reports, a partnership between a first-grade teacher brought used and previously discarded books to the free school-wide event.
If it's hard to remember what it's like to be in the first grade, here are the broad strokes. It's an era of asking a lot of why questions, specifying your age with and a half, and still needing a little extra help with winter wear.
Amanda, are you helping zip up coats?
Yeah.
Amanda Queenie is a first grade teacher at Mountain Village School on the Lower Yukon River. She sees every day how, in addition to being really into Paw Patrol, first grade is also when the students start becoming curious about books. In first grade, students learn the fundamentals of reading they will continue to build before textbook learning.
So this part is just crucial down here of that part. And I think that having these books just brings a level of excitement.
Like many schools across the country, Mountain Village School, part of the Lower Yukon School District, used to have a book fair. Typically, a national organization like Scholastic would send books for schools to display in a pop-up bookstore. But about 5 years ago, Queenie says Scholastic announced they would no longer cover the cost of shipping books, which made the event too costly for Mountain Village, off-the-road system in the already pricey-to-ship-to state of Alaska. Queenie says she understands the reasoning behind the decision, but the 200-person school missed the book fair. Families asked about it, and the school continued to look for ways to bring it back.
It just kind of was one of those things where Alice this fall said, would you like to have a book fair? And I snapped it up right away because we've been looking for options, asking all kinds of different people and entities, and no one ever, you know, follows through.
Alice is Alice Culhane, the executive director of Bright Lights Book Project, a Palmer-based nonprofit that began by rehoming books found at the local recycling center. Eventually, the idea blossomed into a project of collecting discarded or donated books from schools and libraries across Alaska to be redistributed to communities in need of reading material. In the past, Culhane had worked with Queenie to deliver boxes of books to the school now and again. Then, earlier this fall, the two started scheming up a way to use the donated books to bring back the book fair.
What we're doing is we're embracing literacy by making books available to kids. They then own these books. They can begin their own libraries. Their parents are excited. The teachers are excited. And this is going to assist in getting them to be readers.
Bright Lights Books donated around 600 copies of everything from board books to chapter books to be displayed at the fair. Last year, the nonprofit was awarded a state Senate appropriation grant, allowing the project to focus on getting books to Alaska's more remote communities. Culhane traveled to Mountain Village for the project and spent the lead up to the book fair reading with Queenie's first grade class.
We finished setting up this afternoon, and as all the kids would pass by in the hall, their eyes got really big. Just, what's going on in the library?
Beginning January 16th, students of all ages got to shop at the three-day book fair, selecting titles they could take home for free. Students could also purchase things like erasers, Play-Doh, and pencils as part of a school fundraiser to support the Dolly Parton Imagination Library, a national nonprofit Mountain Village also partners with to get books into families' homes at no cost to the students. Queenie says the fair was a massive success. All but a few books were left after just the first 2 days of the event. She says she hopes this book fair model and partnership with Bright Lights can be an inspiration to other schools off the road system. In Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Eric Stone and Clarice Larson in Juneau, Ava White and Aliona Neidzin in Anchorage, Ashlyn O'Hara in Kenai, and Samantha Watson in Mountain Village. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight was Dave Waldron. Tim Rocky's our producer. And I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Everybody's talking, but they don't say a thing. They look at me with sad eyes, but I don't want the sympathy.
sometimes you can't go back. But why'd you have to go and make a mess like that? Well, I just have to say before I let go. Have you ever been in love? Have you ever had a friend that let you down? So when the truth came out, were you the last to know? Or you left out in the cold, 'cause what you did was wrong. No, I don't need your number. There's nothing left to say, except I never thought it hurt this much to
sky. like these time and time again.
Let's go. It's times like these, do we activate? Do something to improve, don't procrastinate. I've been cooking out, make a wicked pass to play. Stream games at 11, but I clap at 8. And I'll jiggle FaceTime if you tempt me. Time to pay back all the health docs lent me. And for me, West 10's elementary. But right now, I wanna see Labra go empty, you get me?
You make it better together, we make a better life. Because the pressure is ever upon us every night. And every day, so we pray and we will forever fight. We make it better together, we make a better life.
I'm a one-way motorway. I'm the one that drives away and follows you back home.
Had gotten their fill. They told me nobody ever gets us down on our knees.
Have no apologies for being. Find me where the wild things are. boy, you should know that I've got you on my mind, your secret admirer. I've been watching you.
Oh.
Heads up to everyone. The Alaska Board of Fisheries is accepting proposed changes to the subsistence, personal use, sport, guided sport, and commercial fishing regulations for the Bristol Bay, Arctic, Yukon, Kuskokwim, Alaska Peninsula, Aleutian Islands, Chinook, and statewide finfish management areas. Finfish includes salmon, herring, trout, other freshwater finfishes, and groundfish, including Pacific cod, for consideration by the board in its 2025 to 2026 meeting cycle. To ensure the proposal book is finished in advance of the board meetings, the board sets Thursday, April 10th, 2025, as the proposal deadline. Proposals may be submitted online, by mail, or fax. If you'd like to submit online, information is at www.adfg.alaska.gov. By postal mail, ADFNG Board's Support Section, P.O. Box 115526, Juneau, Alaska 99811-5526, and fax 907-465-6094. All proposals must be received by Thursday, April 10th, 2025, at the Board's Support Section office in Juneau. A postmark is not sufficient for timely receipt.
Maybe it's running and the grill is gone. And I'm not sure if I'm still respected.